accession number 11928, rule 5.
Is Ian Fraser reel 5?
Well, of course, you'll appreciate, Conrad, that the fuel of a hurricane is very limited, and he'd be on boost the whole time to move about very quickly. There was no hanging about, and very soon he'd used up his. He had to have a reserve. He had to go to Archangel. The reason being that they had a Russian stroke British airfield just north of Archangel somewhere. I forget the name of the place, and he landed there. I believe he got quite a decent award after the things had settled down. Well, he deserved it as well, because you see, just to hang on this chap in the hurricane a moment. I take it would be Fleet Air Arm. I mean, I could check that. That's history anyway. What he belonged to, but to have to sit there from sailing on the what was it, 7th, to he took off on the 18th. Sit there day after day, in and out the cockpit, mostly more in than out, not knowing when he's going to be flown off. You know, sort of the mind. You know, you really. Everybody did something awkward, really, in a way. I suppose that's war. Everybody's got to do something that doesn't suit them. Then, of course, we were without air cover because the carrier had gone back. He'd gone, but we did. The Russians from the same airfield did have a few Catalinas. We must have given them the Catalinas, and they started to deploy those. They were more used in a relay role, passing the messages about submarines on the surface to the convoy. They didn't do much. They couldn't do much attacking, being flying boats. But then we were running short of coal. We'd had a deck load, and the skipper told us to start breaking up non-essential wood, stuff on the deck, various things, because he could see we were running into a gale. There was a gale forecast in the Vena approaches, which was the entrance to Archangel itself, and they told us to get rid of any lockers and anything that could be used as fuel just to get us in. But we had to anchor in the Divina approaches, because there were no pilots to take us in. They weren't organised. We couldn't. Nobody could navigate their own ships in. We had to wait for Russian pilots, and that took organising. So that was about 24 hours. And during this time, the German aircraft, who were then based at Petsamo, which was all on the spot, more or less, Archangel, Murmansk, Petsamo, you're looking at a triangle which is not very big, and they were dropping mines, floating mines, from the aircraft. So that wasn't very good. The gales, ships were dragging anchor, ships were sending out distress calls. But anyway, we finally arrived in Russia on the 21st. Quite an interesting fact here. I always, taking the ship in and taking it out, apart from action stations, I was always on duty. And my log recorded that we tied up at 10 o'clock. Various textbooks on the subject have us tying up at 2200, 2300, some of them 24 hours out. So, but I think I can rely on my own log for that. Another interesting thing is the amount of coal we had on board when we arrived was 5 tons. 5 tons of coal. Now that doesn't get even a trawler very far. Not 5 tons. Not with three boilers. So we were really down to it. We're nearly on the wood. And that is on record, that we officially on the Admiralty records, that we arrived with 5 tons of coal. So, and then the perhaps you'd care to know about the what the first impressions were. That's a good angle, isn't it?
Please.
Well, there were quite a lot of ships, as you can imagine. But we, as a new ship, we were surrounded by kiddies. A lot of soldiers about. When I say a lot of soldiers, most of them were women. But they got rifles and bayonets, and they haven't got any uniform, they just got shawls on. But we'll call them soldiers, because that is the word that the Russians use. But the kiddies were absolutely starving. There's no question about it. They were living on... in this area we tied up at, just outside Archangel, they were living on berries and black bread. Now that was all they had. And you're looking now at September 1942. So we helped them out with woolens as much as we could, but obviously it's a pretty daunting task to for one trawler crew to do anything. Well, he couldn't do anything, but except, as I say, give them cigarettes, and we got very few of those, and any odd woolens we could spare. But
you didn't give the children cigarettes, presumably. It was the adults.
We gave the children anything they wanted, because they could then use them as barter. They probably wouldn't smoke them themselves, but they got the means of barter themselves, among their own people. But it's quite terrifying to see there was shouting, "Comrade, comrade," and dire poverty. It was obvious that they were in a bad way. Then an air raid started, and I was on the deck, and I thought, we brought all this stuff all this way, and now to see it being damaged and sunk. Some of the ships were still a tanker, they hadn't tied up alongside. But mainly the Germans, I should say, they seemed to slip up. They missed the excellent chance of going all out for the merchant ships before they'd offloaded. They went for Archangel itself, presumably thinking possibly that the supplies had been offloaded. There were enough aircraft around spotting all the time for them to know what was happening, to tell the time from the ship's clock. I mean, they were so close. I mean, they were just all around us. But that was there. They made another mistake. They bombed Archangel. And I was on deck, and I thought, oh, this is terrible. You know, we've come all this way. And the second engineer, a fellow came called Amos. I'll never forget him. He must have been 60-odd then. I mean, he was a reservist called up. And he said to me, "What's the matter, lad?" And I said, "Oh, it's not very nice, this air raid, is it?" He said, "Well, this will make you better." He pulled out a pint bottle of neat rum from his hip pocket, or his coat pocket, or whatever he got on, and had a good slurp of that. And that was quite good. But where he got that from, I don't know. He certainly didn't get it off the Russians. It came off out of our stores, I think, possibly. Anyway, that was the sort of thing that went on. And then, a few days later, I was listening in. I had to take... I had to listen to Reuters press for news. That's one of my duties. So a sort of ship's newspaper could be, well, not edited, you just stuck it on as it came over in plain language in Morse from wherever Reuters sent it from. I think it's Daventry, almost certainly it was Daventry. And they said, they gave the numbers of planes, 40 to 50 shot down, and 3 U-boats sunk in the convoy, and the returning convoy, including the destroyer Somali and another destroyer called the Leander, I was sunk, and the recall I said we transferred four guys among others to the Somali, one of them including this Pedro Kilgo, who had been torpedoed four times, and for all we knew then he was lost again. I mean completely this time, because she'd been sunk. But we didn't know then that she didn't sink straight away. She broke her back in heavy seas. She was she became disabled through enemy action, but didn't sink. But the heavy seas broke her back, and Admiral Burnett said, "Well, there's only one thing to do: that's sink her." So presumably they took everybody off. So it's quite possible these chaps did not go down with the ship. There were all sorts of messages coming in. I used to listen to telegrams in. There was never anything special. Then I made a note that the Somali was thought to have been towed for 3 days when she broke her back, and then was sunk on the Admiral's orders. And I had all sorts of things to do. As a telegraphist, you did all amazing number of things. I had to go on board other merchant ship, and do. They'd be tied up alongside. They'd have a short telephone on site, and I'd have to man the telephone as part of my watch. And of course, most of the other end it was Russian anyway. So I mean, there might, you know, occasionally you get a message that was in English, but a lot of Russian as well, and you just listened to it, and that was it. And then sometimes I had to go on shore and take a telephone watch in a Russian telephone exchange, because in an air raid the Russians all went to ground. They just left everything. It didn't matter what they were doing, they went down an air raid shelter. They never stopped on top, they went down. It didn't matter what it was, what they were doing, they stopped it. So for instance, this sounds ridiculous, but it is true. I saw an engine being driven along the quayside in Archangel one day. The air raid sirens went, the driver and the fireman jumped off, and the engine kept going. Well, that is true. They were sticklers. They could be shot if they didn't obey the orders of the military, and that was to take shelter when there was an air raid. Well, of course, then they were getting into the end of September now, and it was starting to get cold, and it was then by that time snowing, and really, really nasty. And but the old naval spirit was there. I noticed from my log that on Sunday, October the 4th, there was a rugger match played between a flower class corvette, the Bryony, and a minesweeper called the Bergamot. And that was in snow, so they kept the old team spirit going there. A rugger match between the two crews in the snow. Something to do, you know. Nothing else much to do. Right, chaps, let's have a game of rugger. And so they did. That was the Bergamot and Bryony. And that evening I did a coaling watch on the Bryony. And I was all short of stores and supplies, not food. That was up to the cook to get that. I mean, pencils, pads, spares for the radio. Because there was in Archangel a British shore station, naval, and they'd got a few telegraphists up there. I think there were survivors off PQ-17. That's how this station came about, and they were very good, and they let me have whatever they could. The call sign of that station, I'll never forget it, was GQH, was its letter call sign. And Murmansk had one, and it was MGD, that was its call sign as well. So they had two British radio stations based, one in Archangel and one in Murmansk. But again, they were so short of materials they couldn't let us have much. And it was mostly the paper, the pencils, and all the food came off Empire boats. Empire boats were colliers. I've just mentioned the Empire Morn, who had the Hurricane, and they were all colliers, about 12,000 tons or just under. Big colliers in those days, and they carried a lot of stores, and that's how we didn't exist. We got nothing from the Russians. That is sure. We got absolutely nothing from the Russians. It went on all the time, but there was one ship we tied up alongside. It was the USA Cleary. Somebody's name. They used to name them after people. This one's second name's Cleary, and we were the women coal ship in Russia. The women did all the coaling because the men were all at the front at Stalingrad or wherever in those days. And the chief said the Russian coal was no good. He couldn't raise steam on it. And that's the chief engineer. We've got a gang assembled down below. As they put it down the bunkers on the starboard side, he had another gang shifting it to the port side, where they drew it up to the deck and threw it over the side. So we're getting loaded with Russian coal from the starboard side. It's getting thrown over into the harbour on the port side, and this Cleary, the Empire boat, no, the USS Cleary, that's right, was giving us some of his coal in one of the bunkers, so we were getting coal from the Russians on the starboard side, taken to the down below, across the engine room, up to the deck on the port side, dumped over the sea in one of the forward bunkers, and the after bunker they had gratings on the deck which you used to open so the coal could go in. So we were being loaded with English or American coal, or whatever coal it was, good coal in other words, at the same time. And whether the Russians knew anything about it or not, I mean, they must have been blind not to see it going on. But this happened. Nobody, you see, I must say here, at this point, most of the vessels up there were all fired, apart from the merchantmen, who'd got their own coal pretty well. Because you'd always had new merchantmen coming in, and they could use this Russian coal, it seemed, but we had rather sophisticated engines, and they weren't as rough and ready as the merchantman engines, which were bigger and would burn practically anything, and we just could not use their brown coal. And it was, you know, very new coal. When I say brown coal, so it wasn't like Welsh steam coal or anything like that. It was literally brown, so the seams must have been fairly new geologically, I suppose. But went shopping in Archangel, and there was absolutely nothing in the shops. The only thing I could ever buy was skates, which seemed to turn out just skates, which just the metal part, and just if you wanted to skate, you screwed them onto the sole of your shoe. They just had holes there. People just screwed them on. So they were cheap things, you know, just stamped out. All right, as souvenirs, I suppose. But they had nothing. The International Club in Archangel, as you probably know, in Russia, the admirals mixed with the sailors. There's no
hierarchy.
No, none at all. I mean, as I say. They, regarding, you know, the chap I was talking about coming here, the admiral, I mean, when we were up there, they refer to sailors in the various letters I've got, but all those sailors were commissioned officers, so they just refer to one another as sailors, and that's it. I'm not saying discipline wasn't any different in any navy, but they just did mix. They mixed in the international club. You had admirals and you'd have anybody, but that was interesting. The first time I ever had any Russian vodka, the wood spirit. This is the real wood spirit. Sitting in the International Club, nice and warm in there. Wood fires, big stoves, about the only place that was warm in Russia, I think. And we were drinking. We always went ashore in a group of four or five. I think it was more for safety than anything, just so we could see one another, right, if we, you know, got in tangle with anybody else. And we were drinking there, and somebody decided to go back to the ship. It was getting late. All four, five or six of us, whatever it was, every one of us fell flat on our face as soon as we got outside. Bang, literally, flat. You didn't notice the vodka you were drinking in the warmth, but as soon as you got outside in the cold, bang, out you went out cold. Snow should woke you up, I know that. But it was... There was literally nothing to do, as I say. I was very lucky to meet these Russian commissars of art, who really were... They were great. They were very, very helpful, indeed.
They got you to do a picture there, or they did a picture of you?
They did a picture of me. They asked me to bring a pal from the ship, and if I would sit for this particular commissar with my friend, he would then send it to Moscow, a museum in Moscow, as indicating the Allied soldiers.
And for that you got pinned?
For that I got paint and brushes, yes.
We did talk about this earlier, but
yes.
You didn't put it on tape.
Oh, that's right. They very, very encouraging, and they helped out to that extent. They said they haven't got much, but what they could spare I could have if I would do this sitting for them. So that was fine. Another little job we had while we were there is we used to take stores around to the ships. But the main job, which really was why we arrived, and everybody's waiting for the convoy to take off, and Rear Admiral Burnett came on board, and he said, "Well, any you chaps all ready for home and have a good trip up?" He said, "Anybody frightened, by the way?" I hope they're answering. "Nobody frightened at all." Well, this is Rear Admiral Burnett, his exact words. He said, "Well, if nobody was frightened, you're bloody liars." He said, "Because I nearly shat my shelf all the time." Literally. Those are the exact words. "Nobody's frightened, you're liars, I shat myself all the time." Rear Admiral Burnett, his exact words. And of course he was right. Everybody was terribly, terribly frightened, including himself. And he said, "As for the fact you are going back to UK, forget it. You're not going back. You're going to stay and reinforce the Russian arm of the Navy." Cheers all round. I mean, this was most unexpected. We did not expect that, I'll tell you. And one of the reasons we were staying, there was a small collection of minesweepers up there then. And we were attached to a group called MS1, that was Minesweeping Flotilla Number 1, who was at the time working up there. They had about six ships. The name of the chap in charge was Commander Jay, who was mentioned quite frequently, historically. He was a bit of a madman as well, I think everybody was. But as our captain was senior officer among trawlers, mostly we went for the small ships, and we had one main job, and I think it was about the lousiest job that anybody ever got, although the sea was always rough. You might think these telephone watches I mentioned and the watches on board other ships, that was all, but oh no, not that was in my spare time when we were in getting cold. The rest of the time the Admiralty decided to that the convoys weren't frequent enough. Stalin was playing up. This again is history. And they decided to give any merchantman that would sail independent from UK £50 per man. I think that later went up to 100. That's cash in hand before they sailed. And the captain, I never found out what the captain of the ship got, but I know that the deckhand has got £50 to £100 if they would sail independent to the White Sea and they'd be taken care of there. Well, of course, the thing was that the people that took care of them there were us, the Cape Argona, and our sister ship, the Cape Marietta. And we used to take off from Murmansk or Archangel. The captain would have, obviously, the rough details of where these ships might be at any given time and with how many days they might arrive. And all we did was play around in the White Sea in atrocious weather. I'm talking about atrocious weather, gear being ripped off, rails smashed, small boat ripped away, signal halyards gone, aerials kept repairing them, down, up again, all looking for these independent merchantmen. And we'd be on our own, and the Cape Marietta would be probably 5 miles over, 10 miles over there, keeping in touch by RT or Oldislamp. And I think with all I've recorded in the whole of my records, I think we only picked about a dozen up, and we must have in the 3 months we were doing this particular job, I'm sure that we must have gone to meet about a good 50-60 of them. They just didn't arrive. They just never. They just had gone, sunk. Little is known of that facet of the merchant navy. They must have been very either mad fools or very very brave men to attempt that run on their own, because they got no protection whatsoever. Of course, it was in the dark. They ran them, days of little light, so probably the Admiralty thought they could get away with it. But I don't think it was, from my own personal point of view, knowing how many we met and escorted into Archangel or Murmansk, I don't think that it was a very successful idea. But I don't know how long they kept it up, but
how far out would you meet them?
It wasn't a matter of how far out. It was a matter of the actual where they might be. In those waters, you could be 20 miles off the coast, and you're into terrible, terrible waters.